One of the things that I do, among others, is the Ananda Central Ministry has a very extensive website, ananda.org. If you've never looked at it, you ought to. It has literally thousands of pages of very helpful and inspiring information. And one of the features they have there is they call Ask the Experts. And people get to send in questions, and various ones of us around the world receive those questions and write answers. So every so often, some little question will come into my world, and I have to think about it and compose an answer. Usually, the people will use only first names and not really identify themselves, and then they're publicly posted. So I'm going to talk about a question I received because it is publicly posted. It's often true that the way you formulate the question always has in it inherently the answer. And when we ask, often when we can't get answers to our questions, it's because we haven't formulated the right question. And this question that I received from a woman whose name I don't recall says, first she said, I was recently married in the last couple of years. In the last couple of years, I've been married. I've been forced to drop out of medical school, and I had to terminate a pregnancy. Then she puts, not by my choice, referring, I believe, to medical school and the pregnancy. I don't know about getting married, but let's assume that that was by choice. And she says then, I've lost faith because of these experiences. So I'm sort of, you know, just mulling this over, wanting to really give her a solid answer. And it finally occurred to me that the key to her question is, what has she lost faith in? I've lost faith. She didn't even finish. But obviously what she's describing is, things have not gone as I want them to go. I feel helpless in the face of these changes. I don't know, she doesn't give me her whole life story. Did her husband make her drop out of school? Did her husband make her terminate her pregnancy? Did finances? Did health? Whatever it was, clearly she feels she's not the master of her destiny, and her destiny is not going as she wants it, and therefore she's lost faith. Has she lost faith in herself? Has she lost faith in other people? Or by implication, has she lost faith in God? And she's lost faith in God because he's not doing what she wants him to do. He's not giving her what she feels that she should have or wants to have. He's not going to make her happy in the way that she thinks that she needs to make happy. Now, I'm not mocking this at all. This is not a small thing. I mean, having faith, having the capacity to believe that the effort is going to be worth the result, is fundamental to life. If we ever lose the belief, if we ever lose faith in the idea that the effort is going to be worth the result, then that's really the beginning of the end for everything. I mean, those are the lifetimes when we just basically sit it out, you know, just sort of take a holiday. Maybe we literally go crazy for a while, which is a nice way to take a holiday. We just retreat into our own world and we don't have to deal with it anymore, or we function way below our potential, or we become very cynical. We commit suicide, which is looks like a good idea, but is a really bad one because it just doesn't take you anywhere. But we just decide that it's not worth the effort, and we just begin to hope that something else is going to happen. My own name is Asha, and that name means hope. Swami Kriyananda gave me that name as a spiritual guide and a blessing when I was in my early 20s. My first response when he gave it to me was, I was just so happy, it was so simple, that I didn't have, we always joke about it, you're afraid to ask Swamiji for a name because he might call you Rupa Manohari Dasi, which is the epitome of the most impossible name you can imagine. I even heard Swami recently threaten to name someone Rupa Manohari Dasi. I mean, it's a real name, but heavens, in America, it would be a handful. Every so often, someone from another culture, from India or elsewhere, will come to our church and I'll say, what is your name? Man will say, Bill, Bob, or one really simple, D. I said, no, that's not your name. I know that's not your name. And you can just see how they've just given up, you know, really trying to say this out to people. It's just a matter of culture, but what we're familiar with. When we went to India one year, we used to take, my husband and I and two of our friends used to lead pilgrimages to India. We did it about a dozen times over 20 years. And one of the men who went with us, what's the word for potato?
Alu.
Alu. His name was Alu. He'd actually been named for that baseball player, Matty Alu, from years ago. So his name was A-L, it might have been O-O or A-L-U. And when the first days when we're on this India pilgrimage, everybody's wearing a name tag. So he's walking around, and his name is Alu, which means potato. You know, so it's very confusing to the Indians why he's wearing the word potato, you know, on his chest. And when they found out it was his name, they just couldn't contain themselves. You know, did your mother hate you? She called you potato? You know, these very ridiculous things can happen. Swami Kriyananda was talking last week on the satsang that he gave that we'll watch at the end of this. When Ram Smith first went to Italy, Ram Smith, for those of you who don't know him yet, he's a big man, he's a black man, he was a football player, he's a gospel singer, he is a fearless human being. And he decided that this little problem of language was no problem at all. He'd just plow forward and speak Italian or something like it. And there's endless stories. If you ever really want to laugh, you just sit with someone and let them tell you stories about Ram speaking Italian. But one of the things was the word kosha, Swamiji was saying, and in Sanskrit means the sheath that keeps you in your ego. In Italian, that word means thigh. So Ram gave this very inspiring class about how what you really must get rid of is the koshas. And everybody was hearing. He made no explanation of what that meant, and his Italian was so fractured anyway that they just thought he was telling them that they had to get slimmer thighs and that that was... You know, and it was sort of like, this is a very hard teaching. I just really didn't know where to go with it. He gave another class. Poor Ram, you know I love you if you're listening to this somewhere on the internet. He gave some other class, I believe it was him, and inadvertently he was talking about the importance of dresser drawers. Again, one of those just strange misuses of language where some important word that he signed a fractured letter was really dresser drawers, and the whole sermon was all about the importance of dresser drawers. And we can really get ourselves in trouble here now, coming back to where I am about this poor woman. That's why I was starting with the word hope. That was the point. But, you know, over the years, as I've lived with this name and lived with the reality of what's behind that, at first I didn't really have any idea what it really meant. But the longer I live, the older I get, the more I appreciate that as long as we have hope, we can go forward. And as soon as we lose hope, then we lose energy, we lose everything else. But a great deal of the difficulty that we have is that we put our faith in the wrong things, and very often we try to enlist God's assistance in cooperating with us to give us what it is that we have defined that we want. I mean, it gets so convoluted, you can just drive yourself crazy thinking about this. And this all comes from this poor woman saying to me that she's lost faith. Then we come to our reading today, and it's like, does God hate us? Does Jesus really hate us? I mean, why on earth would he say, I come to set, you know, a family against itself, the mother against the wife, the children against their parents, everybody against everybody, and you think, like, this is a teaching I want to embrace? It's like, why would I ever even want this? But of course, you have to put this in context, and it also tells you a little bit about how we have to understand spiritual teaching. And it also tells us a lot about what the vibration of Jesus' consciousness must have been like. Swamiji and Master have worked hard to try to correct in our thinking, you know, what the spirit of Jesus must have been. He must have been a very joyful character. He must have been a deeply loving person. He must have been able to imbue people with a tremendous sense of faith and hope in their own potential for happiness. Because that's what we're all seeking. I mean, only a very twisted mind really goes out for masochism. And even if we accidentally end up there, it's only because in our misguided way, we thought that somehow this was going to bring us what we really want. So for Jesus to be able to stand and say, I come not to bring peace, I come to bring a sword, I come to set you against your own family, I'm going to teach you how to lose your life. There must have been under that this overwhelming vibration of everything that people were really seeking. You know, spiritual teaching is not that simple, or not that not that obvious sometimes in the words that are spoken. And the whole process of being a spiritual warrior, which is the word that Swamiji used there, it is to really understand not just with the words that are being spoken, but also with your intuition and with your heart. Swamiji has recently written a book. It's called Rescuing Yogananda. And in fact, this evening at 7 o'clock in our house, Chela Bhavan in the community, I'm going to be giving a satsang discussion about that book, if that's relevant to any of you. But what he's writing about in that book is these profound and deep misunderstandings that have been perpetrated in Yogananda's name, primarily by the organization he founded, by deeply devoted disciples who have yet become slightly confused in their understanding of that teaching. And he calls it Rescuing Yogananda because he feels a mission from Ananda and himself to really restore this fundamental teaching. Now, he's not just talking about one organization and one guru. He's talking about this tremendous tendency to misunderstand what the spiritual path is about altogether. And now it's easy to understand, because on one hand, we have these really fierce instructions from the gurus. You know, they tell us this: you must renounce everything, you must turn away from everything. I remember when I was first, many years ago, when I was first teaching up in the city of Seattle, when we still lived at Ananda Village and used to sort of be circuit preachers. We'd go out to various cities and do these little spiritual campaigns and then come home again. There was these two girls. They were Hungarian. I always remember they were Hungarian because they are the same country as Zsa Zsa Gabor, and they had a little bit of her joie de vivre about life. Two sisters, and they were so enthusiastic. They just sort of became totally enamored of me and what I was doing. I think it was just more personal than anything, as it turned out. And they came to all my classes, and they were so excited, and there was all this going on. And then at 7 in the morning, about a week and a half after they'd started coming to everything I was doing, they phoned at 7 in the morning and said they absolutely had to come and talk to me right away. So I said, sure, and I invited them over to speak, and they had Whispers from Eternity in their hands, what Rita read from this morning. And there's lots of poems in there that are really similar to this particular reading from the Bible that says things like, you think this is making you happy, but this is really poison. You're just going to have to throw it away and transcend it and go somewhere else. And there was apparently one in there about sex, or at least you could read between the lines that was what they meant. And these two Zsa Zsa Gabor sisters came to me with horror in their eyes. That's the only thing I can think of, and said, is this really what you're teaching? You know, like, are you luring us in here with false promises and then you're going to take everything away from us? They were just completely stunned, and I never saw them again. Because they would think, why would anybody in their right mind embrace this? You know? So there has to be, if you're really going to understand and if you're really going to be on a spiritual path, and I'm not just talking about self-realization, we're talking about the Bible here. We're talking about fundamental Christianity, which says, and it says it in a very real way, you know, this world is not what it seems. And this is why Swamiji says to us, the sword that he's advocating is not a physical sword. He's not really suggesting you go out and stab all your relatives and that'll somehow make you free. It's the sword of discrimination. It's a very interesting word, discrimination. Discrimination is the ability to look very sensitively at things and discern many different levels of reality. And the best way to understand these teachings is, it's not as if God is telling you that all of your life experience is false. You know, the individual's attraction to sexual experience, to all of the other things that the senses offer us, to this whole perception of life as progressing in a certain way. It's not like we're completely stupid and misguided. God made us this way. He calls us to these things for very good purpose. It's not like we're supposed to reject and not relate to anything in this world, but we're supposed to discern through it deeper and deeper levels of reality. I mean, Master explains it, that God calls us to human love because we need to learn selfless loving. And it's not really that he's calling us to it because what we need is solid families. What we need is to produce more and more little self-realizationists. I was reading in National Geographic about one of the polygamous cults somewhere, in which really their job is to just produce as many children as they can. So the men have lots of wives and the wives have as many babies as they can because they have this theology that has them both in this world and in the next world. And there's just power in numbers. And the best way to get them is to just make them yourself. You know, I have a hard time really feeling that that's a really high teaching. But the inner impulse that all of us feel to find a mate, perhaps to have children to raise, at least to have friends, this is God implanted. But what we have to understand, and this is an amazing thought to contemplate, everything on this plane of existence is a symbol of something more profound. Because this world is so much more accessible to us, we tend to think of it as the great big starting place. And I know a lot of us, even when we even imagine it, somehow this is the big world, and because we go inside to perceive the other world, there's this obvious sense of shrinking, isn't it? When we were designing this altar here and made the spiritual eye big like that, when we had the first idea to make the spiritual eye, which is the image that you see when you go into the spirit, big, it was hard for anyone to understand whether that would be attractive or not. So one year, we laid out cardboard and we got foil of the right colors, Christmas wrap of the right colors. We made this giant cardboard spiritual eye, which we pasted on the wall up there. It was all shaped very differently then. That one was 5 feet across, you know, just so that we could get used to it. And when Swami Kriyananda came to visit, because not everyone agreed that it be so huge, I asked him, you know, what should we do? Oh, he said, it should look big enough to walk right into. You know, and that really sort of says it. It's like that is the world without limitation. You see, the pyramid is actually reversed. We are right now the most contracted that we will ever be. The pyramid is point downward. And we are this little compressed identification with the ego, and the ego is the soul identified with the body and all of the things that are related to that. There's nothing evil about it. It's not sinful. It's not a bad thing. It's merely less than we actually are. You see, father, mother, friend, father, mother, daughter, son, sister-in-law, what are all those relationships? Those are all the relationships that come when we start by identifying ourselves with this one physical body. And so instead of knowing ourselves as infinite and therefore equally present in all of creation, which is what Jesus and all the masters have always asserted, we draw ourselves down in saying, this is who I am. And I have love all right because I love you. And I receive love because you love me. And as Master says, somewhat, I must say abrasively, he says, we love people as long as they please us. He says, that's not really loving. That's just seeking for yourself. And this is the reasoning behind everything that says expand beyond this. Not because it's bad. Master refers to his companion in their great adventure was basking in the familial warmth, and therefore the adventure of self-realization looked less attractive to him. I'm just going to stay here with my mother and my father and my brother, and it's comfortable here and I like it here. Now, there's only one problem with that. It's really a very simple problem. In the end, it doesn't work. If it worked, it would be just fine. If it was really going to satisfy our hearts forever, then why would the masters tell us anything except find yourself a little family, create a little familiar warmth, hunker down and enjoy it? But, oh my, there's so many other conditions in this world. You know, merely giving birth to a child doesn't guarantee that that child is going to actually be a friend? You know, I remember once this couple was having trouble with their son, and they came to Swamiji and explained all the trouble they were having, and Swami, just to challenge them, said, "Well, perhaps you got a lemon." Nobody thinks they're going to get a lemon, but sometimes you get a lemon because there are lots of lemons. You know? And then after he let them absorb that for a moment, he said, "But I don't think so." And then they went on, and in fact, the lad did not turn out to be a lemon, but he did not turn out to be anything that his parents had hoped for. He did not contribute to the little picture of familial warmth that they wanted. And then sickness comes, and then people change, and you marry someone in a good year, and then the rest of their horoscope kicks in after that. You know? Those of you who are more than six know what I'm talking about, right? And some of you who are six know that too. These things happen. Death, disease, financial destruction, earthquake, war. I don't mean to be doom and gloom, but it's a very simple problem. It doesn't work. And what we have to use is we have to use the sword of discrimination, and we have to say, what am I really looking for? And where will I really find it? And the beautiful thing about it is, it doesn't mean that you have to turn your back on everything else, but it definitely means that wherever you are, you have to be using that God-given understanding to tune in and relate to the right dimension within it. For one simple reason, nothing else works. And it isn't a question of my declaring that as a dogma and that you have to do this. It's that we ourselves have to just use our discrimination and say, this makes me happy, but what would make me happier? You know? This may lift my spirits, but what would lift it even more? What would really give me hope? This poor woman who's written to me, she's lost faith that God is going to come through for her according to her plan. So now what will she do? She can either reject God and go try to get another plan and make that one work until inevitable karmic and world forces will just come in and blow that one up. Or she can say, maybe I need to understand on a deeper level, what is it, where will I place my faith? I recall at a certain point early in my spiritual life, this realization came to me. I became distressed because something didn't seem to be working out the way I wanted it to. And I thought to myself, what kind of faith, what is real faith? And what I realized is, real faith is the faith that God will send me what I need for my ultimate happiness, and he will also give me the strength to deal with it. And in the end, really, that's what all faith is about. Because if you say to God, I will believe in you if you meet my standards, that's a question that can't ever be answered. That's a prayer that can't ever be answered. God, do it my way, and then I'll believe in you. As if, like, he needs us to believe in him. It's like saying to the fire, don't burn me, and then I'll respect you. Fire is just going to burn. Karma is just going to play itself out. Truth is truth. Our ultimate happiness comes the greater we expand our awareness, the more we understand the truth of this reality. And we can squeeze a little happiness out of less, but to the extent to which we limit ourselves, to that extent we open ourselves to suffering. Maybe you have a lucky incarnation and you make it all the way through, but sooner or later, limitation has to be broken. Infinity has to be embraced. And Jesus says, those who cling to their lives, in other words, those who cling to the demand that I want it my way, and in the end, impossible, because it's not reality. It's just as simple as that. Those who open themselves to the great flow of the infinite with the faith that true bliss lies in self-expansion, and whatever the path to that self-expansion may be, God will walk that path with me and give me the strength to walk it. He who clings to his life will lose it. He who lets his life go for the sake of embracing the infinite, then the infinite becomes your all. Bless you.